Welcome to the newest episode of Walnut Grovecast. I hope that you have had a chance to vote in the Walnut Grove 1883 election, which I think is a lot of fun. To vote, visit walnutgrovecast.com and look for the link. I would like to thank the following supporters for their continuous support. David Webb, Dana Wilkins, Chantel Dubois-Nishiyama, Peyton England, Rebecca Frederick, Angela Bowen from the Looking Back on My Wonder Years, a Wonder Years podcast, Anne Quinn, Jill Stillman, Michelle Plug, Dottie Keshen, Suzanne Holland, Spunky Cheek, Sue Ingalls Wilder, Stephanie Carnes, Whitney Griggs, Leah Mitchell from the Retro TV podcast, Laura Solarin, Kim and Jack Lair from the Unsolved Mysteries Rewind podcast, Chris Hassler from the VHS Rewind podcast, Stacey Keller, Matt Mercier, Dean Butler, Gerald Lang from the OSI Files podcast, Ginny Comer, Ginny Schneider-Mitchell, Jeff Griffin, Julia Monin, Laura Furman, Megan Parker, Melissa Gilbert, The No Agenda Podcast, Rebecca Harris, Sherry Benner, Susan King, Teresa Trapp, Valerie Williams, Whitney, Julia Jin, Chris Cooling from the Forgotten TV Podcast, Don Roberts, Samantha Larson-Randall, Max Duration, Aaron Wortman, and Liz Serha, Brian S., Bobby Young, Brenda Worsley. Thank you so much for your support. If you would like to support Walnut Grovecast, please visit patreon.com/walnutgrovecast. Without further delay, please enjoy the newest episode of Walnut Grovecast. Walnut Grove is a place to be. If you live in 1863, hello and welcome to Walnut Grovecast. My name is Mark, and I am on today with Gerald Lang. How are you doing, Gerald?
Hey, it's good to talk to you, Mark. Thanks for inviting me to be on.
I'm so excited to not only have you, you're a podcast veteran. You have the podcast, the OSI podcast, right?
Yeah, it's the OSI Files. I'm the co-host along with the host, John S. Drew. It's called the OSI Files, and it's a podcast where we review the $6 Million Man, and then also that's on Sundays, 8 o'clock Eastern time on Facebook Live.
So you
then
do Wednesday, these live, right?
I mean, live. Like, there's no, you got to be able to wing it and be able to be prepared and be able to wing it. And then on Wednesdays, actually, there's a John and then another co-host, Elizabeth Goddard. They do the Bionic Woman, and that's also the OSI Files. And it's a show we've been doing 3 seasons, 3 years, and we start the new one up September 20th.
One of my favorite shows as a kid, seriously. I might have mentioned, I came across a Steve Austin doll in a garage sale. I think it was last summer. Do you have any $6 Million Man or Bionic Woman memorabilia?
Yes, I have some that I purchased. I don't have any of my original stuff, but I have the one that everybody remembers, the Steve Austin where he could doll,
you look through the eye.
Yeah, and those literally were modeled off the G.I. Joe figures because they're bigger, 12-inch ones compared to nowadays are little, six-inch figures like Star Wars. But, yeah, everybody had that, and everybody would go to the playground on Mondays because the show was either on a Friday or it was on Sundays later. And Monday morning, you were with kids in the playground talking about Steve Austin's adventures.
I love the show, and you could almost see them around, like, a table, and it's like, all right, well, look, we have a G.I. Joe. How are we going to make him a bionic man? Give me a drill, just right through his eye. But yeah, I don't know what it was about the $6 Million Man that really kind of made me so into it, but it was a show that really, really resonated with my childhood. And definitely, where could people find your podcast?
Oh, you can find us on Facebook at the OSI Files. Mm-hmm. That's where John has most of the the info about the show. We have old episodes. And like I said, we do them live on Facebook. And then it's the recorded where they're on iTunes and Stitcher and all the other places you can find them. Season 4 starts September 20th. Just like the show, every year we do a new season. Just like on the show, you had a new season. And then they're starting Season 2 of The Bionic Woman on Wednesdays, which is that following Wednesday, which is the 22nd, I believe.
I love the touches of all that. And I do – I love the idea of live. It's something I've played around with and I've experimented a little bit with. It's just – I don't know if it is a decent amount of pressure. So I really applaud you guys sticking to that and doing it.
Yeah, it's a lot for John. Controls most of everything, all the sounds, the video. He's got that going all at once while we're talking live. I'm basically the co-host that he brought on. Mm-hmm. I don't have to do as much work as he does, but it's funny every now and then. People know my cat now because we have our video cameras on, so people can see my cat, Aki. She'll come up in the art studio here, hop on my desk, and she'll stick her face into the camera. And people know her by name, and people, you know, over the last 3 years, or John's, you know, his kids will pop in from behind them. And
yeah, they become like small parts of the podcast. And I think that's what's so great about doing a show at home is sometimes you get these little the characters that you're surrounded by, you know. But so in $6 Million Man from 1975, and we're talking about a show today also from 1975. Do you want to talk about the episode that we'll be reviewing today?
Yeah, it's the Haunted House episode. I believe, at least on my DVD box, says it's episode 5, even though on the internet it said episode 3 in one place. And it had a date of like October 8th, but yet I seen in another place it was September, I think, 25th, maybe, of 75. It was episode 5, which was kind of odd, the information.
I have a TV Guide archive, because of course I do, right? So this is one of those things. I'm pretty sure I have a bunch of them from 75. So I'm curious to dig through them and see if I can find the TV Guides and kind of see if I can figure out exactly what the situation was there. I think what was part of the problem is following this was 2 weeks. I'm kind of wondering if something big happened in the news. But also on November 5th, you had Remember Me Part 1. And that wouldn't get followed up until the week later. And then they seem to, like, they kind of jumped around. Because at least on IMDb, they list episode 9 as the camp out. But that goes back to October. So, yeah, I kind of want to bust out my TV guides and find out what the situation is. It's kind of funny. But The Haunted House, it's one that a lot of people, I think, struggle with. But I've always liked this episode. It was not in heavy rotation when I was a kid. Do you remember this one when it first aired? Or is this one that you only discovered when you went to go revisit the DVDs?
No, this I more recently discovered. Like we were talking previously before the show, I was, you know, 6 years old roughly when this episode was on, and a lot of it was watching this was my parents. We all, you know, people that are our age, most of the time our parents controlled what was on TV at night, and we watched what they watched. Yeah. You know, I remember sitting, like I said, sitting on my grandfather's lap. He'd be cutting his, you know, slicing up apple, and we'd be eating that and stuff. I don't remember this episode. But I got the box set this past year for my birthday, so I'm revisiting, and I'm actually on season 2 going through the whole thing. But I think this is actually a pretty fantastic episode of what I've watched since the pilot. I think it's well produced, it's well directed, and everything. Sound effects.
Yeah.
So it originally aired, according to IMDb, September 24th, 1975. As you mentioned earlier when we were talking, Victor French is one of the directors. Victor French, we also learned, I didn't realize this, he directed 18 of the Little House on the Prairie episodes over the course of its total run, which is kind of amazing. It's kind of mind-blowing. I wonder if he always had an interest in becoming a director, and Michael Landon was like, hey, go for it. And this is a very different episode when you take into account the other, it has elements of regular Little House on the Prairie, but there's a lot of stuff that's more thoughtful, I guess, things and kind of esoteric that we just don't normally find in the Little House on the Prairie universe.
No,
which includes Amos, you know, this guy we've never seen him before.
Yeah, you're right. I think overall this episode, everything, it's got almost like an otherworldly feel, I like to say, to the episode. It's very, not almost like haunting, but not quite, because of the subject matter that we learn as the story goes by. But just the camera angles, the choices were very dramatic. Victor, you know, had him, a lot of the shots where he placed the camera on the actors. There's either, it's very classically done,
yeah.
But I think because they had the people from Bonanza that they used, all their production crew come over. But the camera, like when Laura's talking with Mary, telling her she's gonna take Jack and they're gonna go back to his house. You can see the camera's placed like down just a little bit below Laura, mm-hmm. and it shoots up, and you see Mary sitting up in a little area at her desk, and it's very dramatically. Everything is shot in a way that's very classical, almost.
You know, and also David Rose's music is very different in this episode. Actually, I'm going to play a little bit of that. I'm going to play the opening scene where we get introduced to the actor, John Anderson, who plays Amos. What's his last name? I'm kind of lost here. Amos Pike.
Pike, yeah.
But we get a type of music that we don't normally hear. And of course, Harriet has something to say about him. I think I hear a theremin back there, but it could be a violin. It's hard to put my finger on precisely what's going on there.
Nils! Nils, it's that Amos Pike! He's coming! He's headed this way!
You mean the hermit?
No, he's no hermit! He's no hermit! He's a maniac! Get out of here! Out.
Harriet!
What?
Now, immediately when I watched this, I thought, it's overdramatic and very, it stands out among what we normally see in a Little House. He's kind of walking past the window. He's got this staff. It's kind of Hitchcockian. So I started doing a little digging on John Anderson, and apparently John Anderson, who plays Amos Pike, has been in a number of Hitchcock productions and a number of, I mean, he was actually in the movie Psycho in 1960, a small role, but nonetheless, he was in it. But he was in a lot of the TV productions that Hitchcock had brought to life. He also played Abraham Lincoln in Voyagers. I don't know if you're a fan of Voyagers. I am. But what's so strange about all of this is I'm going to go out on a limb and say, I have a feeling Victor French was such a fan of this man's work in Hitchcock films and television productions that he created this episode just for him. And that's where the Hitchcockian camera angles, because I think that's the style that is touched upon throughout this entire episode.
No, yeah, I agree with you. I think to be a director and to be trusted with, you know, when you're the director, you're the head of the production and what you, mm-hmm. You choose, I'll make all the choices, and everybody kind of follows with your lead. To be a director, you've got to have some kind of film background or, you know, sure. Been a fan of film. And, you know, the films back then were only, you know, 20 years or so before where Hitchcock and stuff, you know, we have our films. We, as our age, look at Star Wars or, you know, Lord of the Rings. Well, they were looking at the movies of the 30s and 40s. You know, you had the French New Wave going on in the 60s, which was really influential on a lot of American cinematographers like Spielberg and Francis Ford Coppola at the time. But, mm-hmm. yeah, I'm sure they were looking back at those Hitchcock films. And to be a director, you have to have studied film and have a love of film to want to take the responsibility to direct and bring your vision to that episode.
Yeah, I think that this was paying a bit of an homage to his love of Hitchcock, if he was, in fact, in love with Hitchcock. I could be completely wrong. This is simply a guess. It's just that he did work with Hitchcock a lot, and he really nails it when it comes to this type of character. He comes in for a special item that he had to custom order. I looked in my 19th century Montgomery Ward catalog. I could not find the price on this particular item. I couldn't even find a similar item. I don't know how much it cost. Did you catch that when Nels was counting the money?
Yeah, I caught that. And what made me think as I was going through the episode is there's never mention of his what he did for a living or if he had inheritance, but the fact that he arrived at Walnut Grove before mostly everybody else, and he built that house, which is, you look at everybody else in Walnut Grove's house, brother other than Nellie's...
Olsen's.
The Olsen's, excuse me, the Olsen's. That's it's other than the fact that it's a kind of derelict, it's not cheap to build. That house almost looks like a house built in the 30s, not something to be built in a prairie. But I wondered, do they had all that nice stuff in a house? Was he a rich man? And then he fell in love with seeing her, and then he proposed. But then he went and built the house. I'm like, well, that house was not an easy, cheap house to build back then.
No, it's a weird timeline here because, apparently, I guess we'll get to it. But he built the house for the love of his life, apparently. He seems to be just very wealthy. He's very well, he seems educated, comes off as. But how much was the music box? I'm calling it a music box. It's not really a box. It's one of these wind-up ballerinas.
Yeah, I call it a musical globe, almost.
Yeah, that's what I thought it was. But... he picks it up, he pays. Nell seems surprised that people can do math. He goes, "That's exactly right, Mr. Pike." It's like, here's a piece of licorice, son. But this is Harriet, her response to Mr. Pike as soon as he leaves.
"That's disgusting."
It's like, should be my ringtone. Disgusting. Now, we do get a glimpse of Mr. Pike's house. Is this the blind school? Is this... I think that this was the structure that was used for the Widow Thurman, was it? I think that this is the house that Reverend Alden lived in. This has to be the same house.
Yeah, I wondered myself, but the film wasn't until a couple of years later. I was like, that reminds me very much of the house in the Terrence Malick film, Days of Heaven, where it's up on a hill.
Mm-hmm.
And it's on its own, where you can pretty much move the cameras inside, outside, around the house. And I have wondered out throughout the production how much of that they actually shot inside that house, because they had natural lighting in a lot of the scenes, mm-hmm. where some of it could have been done on stage, but there was some beautiful lighting in that. But yeah, I thought the same thing about that house, if that's a Universal lot-owned house or a production company that they use for other films and distress stuff differently.
Now, one of the things that I thought was weird, they show, he walks to the house, we get that shot, and we see an oil painting, maybe it's oil, with two candelabras lit next to, like, a very much a shrine, right? As an artist, you do really very interesting artwork, and you could find posts that Gerald makes publicly. You do a number of really interesting pieces. You sent me a copy of, you referred to it as a quick thing you did of The Crow. And I'm like, this would take me years and it still would not be as good. But, I love your artwork and you really seem to have an eye to capture the emotion behind something. Do you have any opinions of this painting? 'Cause
I looked at it actually the production could have cheaped out if they wanted to and just made a big print and putting it in a frame. But if you look, that's, I think, an actual, I don't know if that's an antique painting, but you can literally see the layers. Because when an artist does like oil paintings, acrylic, usually you put a gesso and you layer it. Then you layer brush strokes on top of that. We see, when you see a print in a magazine, it's a smooth, nice photo or picture. But when you look at a lot of the artworks, like Frank Frazetta is an illustrator that everybody knows, Frazetta, from his famous 70s illustrations he did for horror and magazine and elm covers for Molly Hatchet, I believe. But if you look at his works or any true artworks of artists that are painters, it's layered. You can see the texture on her photo when the camera's on a certain way lit. You can see the layers of the painting. So it looks like a real painting hung up there. And I wonder if they chose the painting was just something they had on the lot from from some other production and then chose an actress that looked like her when they were doing the scenes of him remembering her, or if they really painted that for this episode.
Now, one of the things, though, that stood out to me, whenever I see paintings like this, I go to the hands. Her hands are way too long. That's my only criticism. Her hands are, at least, if they were real, a good inch and a half too long. And I was just wondering if, I don't know if you have the episode or anything like that in front of you. I just took a screenshot, but it's just kind of interesting to me when, you know, the hands are one of those things that's considered to be the most difficult to capture. And it just seems weird. It's almost like Edward Scissorhands long. Very strange. To go down a conspiracy rabbit hole, she could be part of the Anunnaki, having to do with UFOs. I don't really think that, but definitely oddly strange hands. So we have a scene that you had brought up where he's talking to the mirror. He opens this little crate and he pulls out a very delicate, like we were mentioning, a little ballerina globe where you wind it up and it plays a song. I don't know what the name of the song is. And he looks in the mirror and behind him he sees the reflection of the ballerina. And in his mind, he's creating this separation of reality where he's just imagining it's her. And what do you think of this? I mean, should I play the scene and then we'll discuss it? Yeah.
The scenes, there's pretty good drama going on in the line delivery there.
I think that it's a little unsettling because we're talking about a man who, in the scene, he touches upon a true broken heart.
You should have stayed with me. You'd be the belle of that sociable. After they heard you sing, they wouldn't want to hear anybody else. It's the truth, Lily. That's right. Smile. Next, you'll tell me how you love me. How you'll always be at my side. Then one fine day I'll turn around and you'll be gone, just like before. You lied to me, Lily. What's the good of being so beautiful if the truth ain't in you? Don't go.
Not very Little House in the Prairie right there, but we get his backstory. He clearly lost her somehow, and he's dealing with it in kind of a strange way. You were discussing a bit about the production of that scene and future scenes that are like that, because we get to see a ghostly image of her in the mirror.
Yes.
It's, I didn't know if you wanted to talk a little bit about that.
Sure. I just think it's interesting and how well done it is. You wonder, you know, they show him, he's looking into the mirror, and to his right, you see in the darkness, there's darkness, and then there's her appearing as this a ballerina. You assume it's her he's talking to, his ex-wife, and she's just spinning around, not saying anything. She's just doing the twirls that, you know, whether it's a ballerina or just the dance she's doing. She's in a nice, you know, Victorian style dress, and she's in darkness. Mm. And you wonder how they did that, if it wasn't in camera effect where they had two separate pieces of film, the actress doing in a, you know, lit in a dark area doing the dance, and then the footage of him they filmed.
It's very Broadway too. It's very much something that you would see something like this done in a very well done production on the stage. And you might even question how they did it because, using the mirror. Now, I did want to just mention what he's doing is getting into a weird thing because a lot of people who are very religious watch the show. And I'm wondering if one of the reasons why this show is very unsettling to people, believe it or not, it's, a lot of people don't like this episode. But it reminds me a lot of a practice called mirror gazing. I actually know, and I've interviewed someone named Dr. Raymond Moody, who deals with near-death experiences and contacting the dead. And it's a form of occult. It's a form of It's a form of reaching out to the other side, so to speak. But yeah, I mean, it's also called mirror incantation or scrying. These are very dark. These can be considered very dark arts. And essentially, that's what he's doing. You know, he's really mirrors can be very, very scary in the occult. They can also be very helpful. And it's just really the whole practice of it is very interesting. And the mirror comes into place a lot in this episode. So I thought it was just kind of interesting that all in all, we have really a practice of the occult in the middle of Little House on the Prairie. I wonder, I have to also guess if there was that being pushed by Victor French as well. I don't know what his background and everything was. And but we do see at the end there is a resolution here and a touch of religion. So I have to wonder if there was even a bigger message to be learned here. So we have the kids talking about the entire situation. They're not too far from the house. It seems as though Laura is hanging out with the Olsen kids and people running around. I don't know where Mary is at this point. She's nowhere to be found when they're out having fun, right?
Yeah, the first when I seen the girls come running down, I said, "Is that Mary?" And I said, "No, that's the girl." Looked kind of from when they were running. This looked a little bit like Mary,
she's
but
too shrimpy.
Yeah, no, yeah, Mary's very skinny. Melissa yeah. Sue Anderson wanted the time, especially if you're watching this episode. She's like super skinny, almost like anorexic, yeah. And in her dress compared to Melissa Gilbert.
Yeah. So here we are. I'll play some of this, and this basically lets you know what the town folk think of Amos.
I got you! I got you!
Will you please be quiet?
I'd expect when you catch a rabbit with you making all that noise.
I don't have to be quiet. That's my box.
And my carrot. So nah.
Big old spider in there. It'll get ya.
I'm not afraid of leggy things.
Bet you are of that old house on the hill.
Why should I be afraid of a dumb old house?
Because Amos Pike lives there, and my mother says he's a maniac.
A maniac? What's a maniac?
He's crazy. That's what a maniac is, and he kills people.
That's silly, Willie.
No.
Silly Willie. No, it's just, that just went over everyone's head, didn't it? So they dare Laura to go to the house and say, basically, if you can get to the house and grab something from the house, he can't harm you, right? And in just, you know, she hears some creaking, there's some wind, she freaks out. I think we've all been in that situation where you go to do something a little scary and you chicken out a little bit, maybe. So she runs back and Nellie is not going to let her just get away with it.
What's the matter, Laura?
Yeah, you didn't touch the house. Laura is a
I am not. My pa'll tan my hide if I don't get home and do my chores.
Na-na-na-na-na, Laura is a scaredy cat. Na-na-na-na-na.
Laura is a screaming cat. So, it's a good song. So, yeah, it's really bugging her, right? Because it's like Laura's never the scared one.
You know what was distracting to me?
What?
I was watching the actor, or Willie, if he did it purposely, rubbing and picking his nose the whole time. Like, wiping his nose with his fingers, like, the whole time. And I'm just trying to show that, you know, I mean, he's supposed to be educated. You know, his parents are educated. And, you know, you got Nellie, who the actress Allison.
Allison, yeah.
Literally, she sells Nellie great in all the episodes because she whenever she's talking to like Laura, she looks at her, but sometimes she looks down like or away like she thinks she's better than her and almost isn't worthy of looking at her.
No, when she knows she's better than her.
Well, yeah, that's I didn't want to be that heavy on saying, but yeah, and the actress, the way she sells it, Allison is it's so diametrically different to Laura, that even though in real life they're like best friends, they always were, even back then.
Yeah, but you know, it's Alison Arngrim has helped create, in my opinion, like really a top five most memorable characters in all of television. It's you know exactly who she is and you know exactly what she's about. And she's just sweet as candy and as salty as all anything on the turn of a dime. It's just crazy. And the same thing with Harriet. I think, and you combine these two characters, and you really kind of get this magical relationship that really shows so well on screen, I think. Here we are at the dinner table, Pa's eating all the chickens, a lot of corn on the cob. This is quite a feast that the Ingalls are having. And now we finally have Mary. She decided to get her nose out of the books. All that reading's going to make you go blind. And here we go.
Mom, is Mr. Pike really a maniac?
Who told you that?
Well, Mrs. Olson and Willie and Nellie said he was dangerous.
What a thing to say.
He's just an old man who likes his privacy, that's all.
And has every right to it.
Sure does look scary.
Well, maybe I'll look scary when I get as old as he is.
That old house of his looks as scary as he does. Did he build it?
Mm-hmm. Now, long before the first settlers came here. That's why I think he's got a right to live the way he wants to.
I guess.
You can just let other people say what they want about Mr. Pike. You let that man live in peace.
Right, Pa.
Stop poking that potato and eat something.
So in the next part of the next few scenes we get to see, Laura seems really interested in just getting a piece of the wood that to prove that she's not a scaredy cat. Here's her and Mary talking about things in the loft.
Piece of wood. What? All I have to do is take a piece of wood from that old Mr. Pike's house. And Nellie would have to know that I touched it.
Are you still going on about that? Pa said you weren't to bother Mr. Pike.
Not going to. All I have to do is touch that house. Or Nellie will tease me something off.
I'd rather take the teasing.
Tomorrow's Saturday. Everybody knows that Mr. Pike goes to town on Saturday. Want to come with me?
I can't.
Scared too, huh?
I've got a lot of things to do.
I think everybody's kind of scared of Mr. Pike. Just a little bit. Even Pa. And Pa's not afraid of anything. So she goes to the house the next day. She brings Jack. They're kind of just poking around. I'm just going to kind of describe what goes on because it's very visual. A lot of this episode is very visual. But she's kind of walking up very apprehensive. Jack sees a cat. Finally. And it's an interesting jump scare. It's, again, a very Hitchcockian moment. And the dog jumps in chasing the cat in through, like, a broken window. All the windows are boarded up, and the house is all dilapidated. But Laura decides to follow and walks around the creepy house. And we do get to see a lot of different angles and many different scenes that we don't normally see, with Little House on the Prairie. But she makes her way upstairs into the bedroom. At this point, I think a viewer's kind of conflicted. They're like kind of interested to see what this is all about. But at the same time, she's really violating this man's privacy. The bedroom is beautifully done. It's all clean. It's nothing like the rest of the house. It's even has better lighting. She sees the music box, she turns it on, and she's kind of taken over and entranced, and she's even dancing to the music box. I just don't think it's normal for the Laura character to really be doing what she's doing. So I think that a lot of people might be conflicted in that sense if you're following the trends of what the characters do and don't normally do. We walk around a little bit. We get a shot of Mr. Pike coming back to the house. Finally, she thinks, I better get out of here, and I'm going to play some of this. This is interesting background music, and here we go.
Jack! Come on, Jack. Well, better start to go home. Otherwise, we're going to get it.
And she hears him coming in, and Jack, being the clumsy dog he is, knocks over a vase. And she's hiding and hiding, but finally he comes across her and confronts her.
I'm sorry that Jack broke your vase.
Who are you?
Laura. Laura Ingalls from over the hill.
You come here to steal something, didn't you?
No, sir, I didn't. Just this old piece of wood.
Give it to me. Now I want you to get your thieving self out of here. And I don't want to see your lights around here again.
I'm sorry. It's just an old piece of wood.
Can you hear?
Like, she's really pushing it, don't you think?
Well, what I would like to see, go back and look if there's a way of seeing the original broadcast of someone, of this. Usually when he looks, she looks up at him, I didn't think he was as menacing as he could have been. Usually they'd have him with, like, one eye really big looking, really scary, but usually this is the part of an episode, too, an episodic television. For dramatic purposes, they would have had the camera go up and show him, then it would go to a commercial break. And leave us hanging, like, oh, what's he gonna say? What's she gonna do? Then it would come back, and we'd see the. Then
yeah,
would,
you have that. Start. Yeah.
Yeah, and usually this would be where the commercial break would be to leave us on hanging on the edge of our seats and make us come back and watch the rest of the episode. So I wondered, but I think it went right to him and right back to her. I don't know if there was like the pause where you'd see they could literally put a commercial break right there.
But I do think she's pushing it. I think that it's kind of like she's really, really just. Really being a little bit of a crackerjack, I think. But in this next little bit, I think she really, really just steps over the line with him.
You know, she was being what he calls her later, a snippety snap.
A snippety snap. It's hilarious.
I don't want you to talk to no one about me. Get here!
No, I think he has every right to be angry, personally. I mean, you come home and this girl from over the hill, rifling through stuff, breaking stuff, mangy old dog, country girls. So,
you're not anything to tell anybody about. You're not even a maniac. You're just a mean, selfish old man.
That's pretty mean. Not anything to talk about. So that night, somehow Pa found out, I guess. Maybe he went and told her. We don't have much of a backstory of how he found out. Maybe Mr. Pike told him. I'm not really sure.
But, didn't he say something? I'm glad you came to me about it.
Oh, did?
Yeah, I think when she goes later, because you know, once the shot went to, of him sitting, lighting his pipe and really dramatic, like hanging out. I guess he's called her out into the barn to have a little talk.
Yeah, I actually have that clipped here. I'm going to play that.
Yeah, I think he says. Yeah.
Sorry. Let's see.
Sorry, I disobeyed you, Pa. You going to skin me?
I suppose I should, shouldn't I?
Yes.
I won't.
Of course you won't. You're Charles Ingalls. You're the pushover. Come on. If it was a boy, you'd skin him. That, I think. If that was Albert, he'd be getting skinned.
Everybody disobeys once in a while. The important thing is you owned up to it.
And this is another thing that kind of stood out. We're seeing a different development of characters here. We're going from kind of season one, where everybody's kind of a holy roller and kind of goody two-shoes in a way, to everybody makes a mistake. I know you just did this 2 hours ago, but, you know, let's move on. And it just seems weird to me, all of the quick forgiveness and the no lesson is learned, really, at this point, which I think is also very interesting. Not a great parenting moment, I think. I mean, she went into a stranger's house, broke a vase, and as far as we know, not willing to replace it. Which is very interesting.
Hey, go on. Get some sleep.
Yes, sir. Wish I hadn't talked so mean. He's so old and lonely. That's probably why he's so mean.
Well, I'm sure he's forgotten about it by now.
So she says, I want to go there tomorrow. I want to apologize. And he says, do you want me to... Oh, no, he doesn't say that. He doesn't offer, actually, to go with her at this point. And he says, all right, you go there, you apologize, and you leave immediately. And in Laura fashion, she goes there. And my Ellen episode is after this, way after, right? You happen to know the... yeah, it's definitely after it. So here we go. We're at the house, and we have another scene where Amos is talking to the mirror and the memory. And we get kind of a mixture of a form of fantasy and real life. And you see him kind of like... It's a little bit ajar. You know, his mind just kind of... It was a little wacky. It's almost like when you're a kid and you're singing in your bedroom to a song and your parents walk in or something. Like you're like caught.
In time for the season, we'll walk like we did before. Your pretty hand, mine, you all smiling and warm. You'll like it, I promise. Better than before. A lot of folks around. They couldn't help but love you. The way I do, but then what we got is special. You said it was special, but you ain't live up to what you said.
So yeah, I mean, he's dealing with a lot of very dark emotions. He finally sees Laura walk in. I mean, she just walks in. She basically lives there now. And his response to her is, I guess. Expected.
What are you doing here?
I came back to tell you I'm sorry for all the bad things I said to you yesterday.
Nobody asked you.
Bet you never talked to her that way.
What?
Just as if I was as beautiful as she is, you wouldn't be acting this way.
It's none of your affair. Don't you go talking.
I won't. But she sure will when she gets back. The way you let her house go.
What?
Well, look at this place. It's a mess.
She's very judgy, right? But one of the things that we always like about Laura is that she's pretty honest. And basically calls him out for his house being a mess and how when she gets back, she's going to be angry with him and all of that kind of stuff. So here's a scene where they're kind of, she just offers to help clean, which I think is really nice. It's a good way of apologizing. And here's a little bit of an interaction between the two.
In and out. You take that rug outside and give it a good shaking and I'll see what I can do in here.
You're a real snippity snapper. Yes, sir.
So, yeah, that you mentioned that before. I think that's a cute little thing to say. So they're kind of like almost bonding. In a way. I mean, he's still a grumpy old man. But I think that he likes her chutzpah. He likes the fact that she called him out. How can he not respect a kid who is basically calling you out? She's asking him all types of questions about the woman in the painting, who we learn her name is Lily. So this is what we learn.
Well, I ain't a city man. You go crazy in those stacks of houses, all that noise, people running here and yon. Fella could get run down in the street. I need a fat sun and good clean wind in my face.
Well, you're not getting either of them staying locked up in this old house all the time.
Listen here, you runny-nosed little upstart.
Again, it's an awesome thing. A runny-nosed little upstart? Is that the saying? I think I missed something there. So, yeah, so she's just kind of helping clean, and someone's coming. People don't usually visit him, probably, so.
Looks like someone's coming.
Oh, that's just my pa. I didn't know how late it was.
Ooh.
Now, I love this little scene. I don't know what you thought about it, but the interaction between Charles and Amos and Amos and Laura and how it's portrayed and what it really means. What did you think of this interaction?
Yeah, I really liked all the acting in it and the line delivery. What I thought was interesting, you know, at first you're like, oh, you see her father, like, oh, yeah, he's going to give it to this old man.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost the way he interacts with Amos, it's almost as if he knew him previously, like knew him before Laura, before this episode. He kind of knew of him or had been around him, because you think yourself, he seems like a smarter man, a father that would let his child go to a strange person's house.
Yeah.
You're talking around town. Even nowadays, that would never happen. But back then, he's, you know, Charles has always come across in the way Michael Landon portrayed him as a very loving person, but also very practical and protective of his family.
Yeah, this is a poor decision on his part.
Yeah, I would think so. But my guess is he knew a little bit about him and knew that it doesn't sound like he knew that he had lost his wife when they're later in Mankato on the way when they're discussing Lily.
Right.
But I think he had some kind of knowledge of him to where he, otherwise I don't think he would just let Laura just go to some, it's not like it's Mr. Edwards' house she's going to hang out.
Well, I have a little bit of a dark theory in the, that we'll get to, but I also just noticed I have a freeze framed. Charles's wagon has smaller wheels than normal. I think they normally have maybe 30-inch wheels. These look like maybe 26-inch wheels or something, and they're heavy duty. So now I have to pay attention to not only ferns, which do make an appearance in this episode, but wagon wheels. I'm so hungry I could eat a wagon wheel. Do you remember that from Saturday morning cartoons?
Yes, that was at Schoolhouse Rock. Was that Scatman Crothers?
No, it was
Hanker for a Hunk, right?
Yes, yes.
Jell-O Pudding Pops or something like that.
It was the Hanker for what? It's like you take an ice cube tray, fill it with juice, put a piece of saran wrap over it, and put in toothpicks, and put it in the freezer, and come back, and you have a tasty little treat.
I remember those. Instantials, they were called, or something like that.
Yeah, it's like an ABC type of Saturday morning cartoon. I got to dig that up. You know what? I'll pop that in right here, the little song. See how inaccurate I am with my depiction. But whenever I say the word wagon wheel, I think, I'm so hungry I can eat a wagon wheel.
Yep, that's exactly what you're talking about. I grew up with that commercial, so I know.
Yeah, I loved it. And actually, I worked on the Schoolhouse Rock production, when it came back in the late 90s. So an opportunity to meet a number of the people who are on the original production, which they are characters.
Well, it's on, I think Disney Plus has got the whole sequence, all of them on there. I started watching them about a month ago.
Yeah, slowly. It's amazing. They really hold up. They're really great productions, and it's really, the music is dynamite. Dynamite! So it's enough 70s references, Mark. So we have this little interaction between Charles Amos and Laura.
Hi, Hepbite. Sister Pike.
About time you came for this snippity-snap. I'll thank you to take Miss Laura Ingalls from over the hill back over the hill.
Now, she's beaming. The biggest smile that you've ever seen. He's just being mean. So funny.
I'm sorry if she caused you any trouble, sir.
Time was when decent folks kept their children at home, out of other folks' business.
I suppose you heard that.
I sure did. That's just the way he is. He really likes me.
I love it. I love that so much.
Yeah, I agree. You know what I want to add to that? I think their relationship of father and daughter, he trusts her judgment of people enough that once he sees her interaction and she's smiling and laughing, he probably realized the reason he lets her go back is that he respects her and knows that she's a good judge of characters. Usually we always say kids are a good judge of character of adults around them and kind of have a feel for things. And I think he respects her judgment, the fact that he's grumpy, but he likes her. And Charles can see that, and I think that's why he lets her go back and feels she's safe, because Laura, he feels, is a good judge of character, and he trusts her judgment.
That's a really good point. And you brought up something interesting before as well, off air. You'd mentioned how she's really the focus of this particular episode. I mean, she's the star of the entire series. I think a lot of people kind of forget that, because the development in Little House on the Prairie characters sometimes can be really high development, like the Nellie character. But it's really Laura Ingalls Wilder that is the crux of this entire series. And I love how you said this really reminds you, this episode really reminds you that she really is the focus of the entire series.
No, you're right. This episode especially, she's our gateway. I mean, to the whole series, she's kind of the viewer's gateway into each individual episode, some are based on the book, Laura Ingalls Wilder. But especially in this episode, she's our gateway into this episode. And it seems like all the actors and characters are reacting to her. Like when you see her in Mary, Melissa Sue Anderson, when they're in the loft and Laura's combing, brushing her hair straight and telling her she's going to go back with Jack, it's like you could see Laura, it reminds you how great Melissa Gilbert was at that age and how talented she was. It was very natural. And then you could see Melissa Sue Anderson reacting to her. Her lines at the same time, trying to look like she wasn't scared of that man going with her, was making excuses. But it's throughout the whole episode, there's the dynamics of her, like Charles, Michael Landon, interacting with her, and her decisions and want to keep going back. And he almost is like, he's not judging her being a mean father. He's kind of seeing where she's going with her relationship with this Mr. Pike. And everybody is interacting with her.
Yeah.
And she's like the focal point for us into the story, right through to the end, and learning about Miss Lily and her story and Mankato and everything.
And we learned that a little bit in this scene, and there's a lot of weird things I think are said here. I'm going to play a bit of the clip here. Basically, Laura's talking about who she was and who he was and how they met and all that kind of stuff.
Artist didn't paint her as pretty as she is.
Did you see all her plays?
Every one of them. Not just once. The theater was my courting place. I sat right in the middle of the front row every night.
Now, this is where things start getting a little weird for me anyway. So, the theater was his courting place, right? So, he was her fan, right? I mean, that's kind of what that means. He knew her as a star. I start kind of getting really kind of curious about all of this. So there are a few more hints as we go on.
Where she could see me. After I went backstage. It was 4 days before she even said hello.
Now, when he says, when I went backstage, he's very, very proud of this line. Like, he's very, I got to go backstage type thing. I'm wondering if there was a different direction that this episode was going to go, and they thought, no, I don't think you can go that way. But again, I'm completely probably overanalyzing, but at the same time, there are things there's really no reason to say certain things. The backstory could have been simplified otherwise, but I'll just keep playing it.
Oh, then what?
Then it was the wonder, the glory, sunshine and lightning all at the same time. Came here, built this house, went back and asked her to be my wife.
All right. This is where it gets really weird. So he decided to build the house before he proposes. The guy had to have had or still has wealth. But I just think that's a little backwards. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that made me think, when we were talking, obviously he has wealth, because if you, like I said, you see this house, it's a nice house.
And yes,
he was there
beautiful.
For everybody else, and even though it's, you know, like I said, it's boarded up and stuff, the fact that it's up on a hill, which
wasn't always boarded up yet.
Yeah. And obviously he has wealth. We don't know. He said he's educated, what kind of background he has. And then when he was talking about 4 days, you know, he went and seen her 4 times, you know, once he seen her and he was in love. It reminds me of the story, Tom Selleck, the actor from Magnum P.I., his wife, she was an actress in Cats. And he said in an interview, he went to see the play 4 times in a row because he fell in love with this cat.
Oh, wow.
Playing a cat. And it took him to the 4th day to get the nerve to go backstage to ask somebody, because he's Tom Selleck. He could go back anywhere he wanted, and any girl would fall in love with him. It took him 4 times to go back, he said, in the story of how they met. Jill, I believe, is her name. It's his second wife who he's married to still to this day. And it took him to the 4th time to get the courage, Tom Selleck, to go back and ask somebody what her name was and if he could meet her.
Wow.
And as aside, when I heard him say that, it goes right to my head, because I'm a big fan of the, you know, the Magnum P.I. show, and I think Tom Selleck is like a Melissa Gilbert in the role as Laura Ingalls. Him, we're always going to associate with Magnum P.I. He was just, it was who he was, and I think a lot of Laura's characters who Melissa was at the time as a child growing up.
Wow, yeah, it's that's a great story. Thanks, I never heard that one, but yeah, I'm a big fan of Magnum P.I. as well. Sorry, I just got a little text. Got the pizza, thank you. All right, good. I had to order. In between this, Gerald has been kind enough to wait on hold for a little bit as I ordered pizza for my son and his friend. And I didn't know if they were going to actually let him, because I had to pay by credit card. I didn't know if they would just give it to him because he's only 12. But apparently they let him sign my name. It's so funny. All right, so back to 1875. Sorry. Before pizza. American pizza, anyway. So, I'll play a little bit more of this scene.
When she said yes, I was so happy I was dumbstruck for an hour.
Why'd she go away?
None of your business, why?
I'm sorry.
So, yeah, so we see something's kind of rough. You know, there's some real, real sensitive topics that we're, you know, kind of getting involved in. Ma and Pa apparently have gone to the theater, we learn in the next scene, at some point, anyway. We don't learn this until the very next scene, but it appears that Pa and Laura are going to Mankato, right? So here we go. This is a little bit of their discussion.
You and Ma went to the theater in Mankato, didn't you, Pa?
Uh-huh.
Did you see Miss Lily?
No, I have fine idea of Miss Lily still on the stage. It's been a lot of years now.
She sure looks young in her picture.
I suppose that's why people have their paintings done. So they remember how they looked years back.
You suppose she's as old as Mr. Pike is?
Pretty near, I guess.
I bet if she knew how much that he loved her, she'd come back.
Well, maybe.
And it's just like, all right, Half Pint, you're not taking a hint here. I mean, this is all. I think the viewer understands what happened. Maybe we're even sympathizing with Amos. But Laura goes to Mankato and she sees the theater and she goes in. And I don't think that Laura understands the concept of stranger danger. Right? So walks in. And basically finds out the bitter truth.
Where do you come from, little lady?
I'm Laura Ingalls, from Walnut Grove.
You're a long way from home. Coming here, backstage. I bet you want to become an actress.
No, sir. I'm looking for a lady who is in a
repertory company. Yes, we've had a lot of those. They come and go, come and go.
Well, this lady's name was Miss Lily Baldwin. Do you know her?
I did. Yes, indeedy. No way to forget a woman like Miss Lily.
When will she be back?
By the way, I think you could see Melissa Gilbert's braces in this. I'm not 100% sure, but I think in this scene you can completely see it on her teeth. So I need to go back and look at the HD version, because I'm looking at kind of a lower quality one.
She won't, little lady.
So, yeah, so she got cholera and she passed away about 20 years ago. Laura thinks, for whatever reason, Amos doesn't even know, which I just think is something that should have been corrected with Pa. Like, he should have said, maybe you're overstepping at this point. We get a little bit of a discussion about something, about faith. And you're a pretty religious person, I think, right? You follow a moral set of rules, right? What did you think of this little scene between Charles and Laura?
Yeah, I really like the scene. Like you said, I'm actually a Christian. Mm-hmm. You know, born again Christian. I read the Bible and, you know, pray for people and do that daily. But, you know, I'm not one of these people that's going to hit somebody over the head with the Bible and push it on them. But I think they handled this really well. They put the message of, you know, Christianity or the Bible or, you know, something of faith. And they use terms like faith and belief, which is really what it's at the core and love of what it's all about, you know, Christianity and, you know.
I think all religion, really. I mean, the beautiful thing, I think, as a Jewish person, I think that these are moral lessons that I feel as though we all deserve to not only learn, but to really implement in our daily lifestyle. You mentioned you're a born-again Christian. Does that mean you're Pentecostal?
No, Baptist. Oh, okay. Baptist slant, but it's
I spent some time. I spent some time in an all-black Baptist church when I was a kid. So,
yeah.
Probably the most fun I've ever had in Under the Cross. You know, it's definitely the most party atmosphere, I think, that most churches can create. And two of my closest friends are Baptist. So if I wanted to spend time with them on the weekend and do sleepovers, I was going to church on Sunday morning, whether I was being bar mitzvahed or not. And I loved it. You know, it was just one of those type of things. So,
like I was saying, I thought this was handled really well.
Yeah.
It put the message in there, as we call it, but it was done in a practical way, which anything you want to communicate in life, you want to do it in a practical way that people, broad audience, can relate to without being preachy, as, you know, that's a term that, you know, that people say about certain things you put in television episodes or a message, how preachy things are. But it's done just the right amount to make us understand what he's talking about, what she's talking about to him. The fact is, I believe it's a King James Bible, because the way, you know, that, you know, he says, she says, believeth in that, and wants to, whoever believeth unto me. That's, you know, that's King James, you know, from England, the King James Version, the original translation of the Bible.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's done in a way, and I think, is Michael Landon Jewish, or was he a Christian?
He's Jewish. I don't think he was very religious, but he was Jewish by, bloodline.
So it's possible he understood, you know, what, you know, a Messianic Jew and what the difference between Jews and that, but it was done in a way that was, I thought, was handled really well in the episode, that wasn't going to turn people off that don't really understand faith or really into that, but it's also going to educate people in a general on how to love each other and how to treat each other, because in the end, Laura is loving this man, mm-hmm. Mr. Amos, regardless of how he treats her at first, because I think it's part of her character, and the fact, you know, that she becomes a writer, and this, and all these episodes are really her memories, I believe, all the episodes are, even though we're watching them, it's her recalling her childhood. And she uses all this in her writing, which she does with love, obviously, if you get into reading her books, the original books and stuff.
Now, as the ratings got better and better and the show just gained so many more viewers, we definitely get less and less religion, I feel. And I think that this might be one of the last times that we get, you know, real scripture. I mean, and it's not even heavy-handed. I think that there's a few moments in season one where it's a little heavy-handed, where it's almost Quaker level, you know. But this, I'm going to play some of the scene. I think it's, I agree with you. I think it's a very sweet conversation that Charles has with Laura. And I just wish that the only thing missing here is his sage advice. Or sometimes you just have to leave people alone, you know.
Well, you know, it's interesting, before you go to that, if you think about it, when you think about religion and faith, like Christianity, it's us here and God above. And the way this is filmed, Laura is up in the top of the barn reading it, looking down at her father, and he's like looking up at her lovingly, like reacting very delicately. And it's almost like the back and forth is done away. You almost look at spirituality. We're here. God's up there. He's, our, you always say Heavenly Father or Father God, people will say different religion. And it's shot even that way. I don't know if that was purposely done, but it was, and like I said, there was a lot of camera angles were very similar throughout this episode, very dramatic, but that was even done in a very dramatic, but soft way, I thought.
Actually that comes a little later. What I don't think I explained which clip I was about to, I'm not even up to that point yet. I'm going to play the conversation that they're having after Laura had learned that Lily had had passed away from cholera. But I know the scene you're talking about, and it's another one of these kind of strange angled scenes. It's almost, I mean, I hate to, I guess I don't hate, but I think I'm going out, I'm pushing it a little bit when I say there's a certain twist of Orson Welles type of shot when you get that scene of her opening the barn where, you know, in Citizen Kane, for instance, it's one of the first films where you're actually seeing ceilings. And the reason why you were able to see ceilings is because what they did is they stretched canvas over the tops and they would microphone. They would have microphones pass so that they could people didn't have to wear mics. And just a lot of very interesting things. I think that so much thought and love was put into the cinematography of this episode. And it's just, I really think people should just watch this from, I just think it's a great episode. It's a hidden episode, really, right? There's so much here. But here's the conversation between Charles and Laura.
I wonder what it'll do to Mr. Pike when he finds out.
It's one of the facts of life, Adeline. It's going to come to all of us the moment of God's choosing. It's one of the reasons why it's important to have faith.
I don't think Mr. Pike has faith. He doesn't go to church.
Well, it doesn't necessarily mean he's without faith.
What's Pa eating? It just looks like he's eating some flat bread or something. Just, I don't know. I just expect him to eat something a little bit yummier than whatever that is. String cheese or something. I don't know.
He could just be praying in his own way, same as we did out on the prairie.
I hope so.
You know, even people who aren't much on religion generally turn to God in their time of need.
Does God listen to people who aren't very religious?
Sure he does.
When we get back, I'm going to have to tell Mr. Pike.
Want me to go with you?
No.
You're sure?
Something I have to do.
But do you think Charles, I mean, wouldn't Charles have the, I don't know, the understanding that he probably knows, and this is the root of this person's shut-in behavior. I just think it's a strange one. I think that the better decision would have been for Charles to say that he probably knows, and that maybe you aren't the right person to tell him this kind of information if he doesn't. But, of course, that's not what happened, and Laura goes to the house. We see the first fern of the episode. The house looks great. You know, things are really looking up inside. I don't know how you would, I guess you'd just sweep those rugs. No, what did he do? He took the rug outside, right? That's how you would clean the rugs back then. And it's a little bit of a heartbreaking thing because she comes back and, hold on, I'm just trying to get the clip here. And he's excited to see her. It's like his new friend.
Think, child. You like it?
It's beautiful. But
what's wrong, child?
I went to the theater in Mankato and asked the man there about Miss Lily.
Oh. Got some more cleaning to do.
Mr.
So, yeah, I mean, he knew. And that's the whole thing. He doesn't want to talk about this. We get to the next scene, which is really, really just heartbreaking. It's like he's kind of dissolving right in front of her. He's going around, he's cleaning his bedroom, and he's turning on all the music boxes.
Oh. When she gets her fill of the big city, she'll be back. I don't want to ever hear anymore!
Please?
Get out and don't come back!
Such a surreal scene, you know, with that music. And you have this dissonant, all these echoey, strange sounds, and it all creates this kind of chaos. And we're just seeing kind of a psychotic break almost. But Laura's very upset over this, clearly. It's affected her. She's been pretty open with her father, what happened. But goes back, and they have that conversation in the barn. Should I play that where she reads the scripture?
Yeah, sure, because I kind of like jumped ahead. Yeah. Sorry.
No, don't worry about it.
Moment and flowing along in my head, it's a very, I think it's almost like a pivotal, not pivotal, but it's what the episode at the core is really about. And I think when the writers were writing this, they took a theme, and then Victor French looked at the script and seen thematically what this episode was going to be about and what to reveal. It's revealed what goes on from the beginning to what's revealed at the end of the episode at this point.
I think there's a certain maturity to also that we get to see from Laura that we might not have ever seen up to this point.
No, you're right. Even previously when you were talking, when she tells him and he starts turning on all the music boxes, like we were saying, that is almost very Hitchcockian.
Oh, totally.
French had study because you had all the dissonance of all the different sounds going on. And as a viewer, it's kind of it's not distracting, but it touches us in a way that we feel
It's uncomfortable.
We feel the uncomfortableness of talking about death, which is an uncomfortable thing to talk about.
It's also like in The Birds, you know, Hitchcock. Yes, The Birds, the noise of the birds, and you know, it's uncomfortable, it's unsettling, it's and it's heartbreaking. But here we go. I'm just gonna play. It's a little bit of a long scene, but I really do think it's worth it.
You up there, Half Pint?
Yes, Pa.
Mary said you're doing a Sunday school lesson.
Well, kind of. I got looking, and then I got reading.
Still worried about Mr. Pike, huh?
It's been 2 weeks, Pa.
Well, Half Pint, the more you love, the more you hurt. I reckon Mr. Pike must have loved Miss Lily an awful lot.
He surely did, Pa. And I hurt him something awful.
It's not your fault. You did it out of love. Nothing bad ever comes from the heart.
But it turned out so wrong. I thought that once he knew, he'd stop waiting for Miss Lily. But he won't. He's just going to stay in that old house forever and ever. Why won't he listen?
Just didn't want to face it, I guess.
If only he turned to God for help, like you said. It's right here in the Bible. Jesus said unto her, I am the resurrection and the life. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet he shall live. If Mr. Pike'd only believe that, he'd be all right, wouldn't he, Pa?
Yes, he would, darling.
And I think you really picked up on this, Gerald, where it's really, maybe this episode was created to remind everyone that this is a Laura Ingalls Wilder story. And she's really the pivotal character. And we need to be reminded this. There is such admiration from the Charles Ingalls character to Laura in this one scene. Maybe her growing up and being so thoughtful is so impressive to him. And I just think, all in all, you know, I really, really love that scene. I didn't clip it, so I'm really glad that you brought it up, because I was not going to play that. But it is such a mature, very mature Laura that we are left with at this point.
Yeah, it reminds him of his wife. You know,
yeah, she's, you know what? She's absolutely.
Very spiritual.
Level-headed, you know.
Very spiritual, and it reminds him almost, he sees his wife and his daughter, sees his, you know, daughter and his wife. He sees the same characteristics of what he fell in love with.
Mm.
Mrs. Engels, Carolyn.
Yeah.
And he sees that. He sees in her, Laura, the love, and, you know, the fact that she always talks about, you know, talking throughout the season, up to this, the two seasons, about God and faith. And he sees the intelligent side of her and Mary, and her studying, and Mary wanting to be good. So in the kids, he sees that loving side of her, of Carolyn, how he fell in love with her, Carolyn, because of her, probably because, you know, he loved her because of her love she had. Mm-hmm. And he sees that in Laura. And she's using that love to others, which is, she's sharing with, you know, Amos and helping him what he's dealing with. In fact, she's concerned enough to...
And also, Laura's usually the goofball. You know, she's the tomboy who's running around, you know, starting fights and yelling and getting upset and being overdramatic, and here she is with these very mature themed emotions and thoughts. So yeah, I think you're right. He's starting to see a woman, a little girl with the becoming the woman that Caroline is kind of, you know, instilling, and maybe what he's instilling into her. But meanwhile, back where Willie's probably picking his nose and Nellie's wearing the same dress as before, which is kind of unheard of. They, and a mystery girl, a girl who kind of, maybe she's Melissa Sue Anderson's stunt double or something. She easily could be.
Yep.
But yeah, they're back at it and they're playing Follow the Leader. And they're going to pick on Laura. Because for whatever reason, it's not become public knowledge that Laura is spending time at Amos's house.
Hey, Laura, you want to play Follow the Leader?
No, I don't think so.
You're scared the maniac will come out and grab you.
He's not a maniac.
We might believe that if you weren't afraid to touch that old house.
I don't want to.
Laura is a scaredy cat.
Laura is a scaredy cat.
Laura, everybody, no? All right.
Laura is a scaredy cat.
Now, before this, actually, I jumped over something really big. But Laura leaves behind a Bible in this old dead hollow tree that's in front of Amos's house. And I think she marked the pages. Maybe, you know how Bibles have that the bookmark? Maybe she marked it with that? And he sees that she leaves a book, and he picks it up. And there's this one moment, all visual, but there's a scene where he's reading the Bible, and something just clicks. And he's able to finally accept the truth of Lily's death, goes out to his yard, and uncovers her tombstone. And we're left with this kind of strange moment where, wow, she's been buried there the whole time. And he's just not able to, he was never able to mourn her because he was never able to accept her, the loss of his love. But he leaves in the tree the music box or globe, the ballerina, not a ballerina, but the dancing girl. And Laura sees it, and she goes and brings it back to him, says it's too pretty to give away, and confronts him. But I love that whole thing. You know, it's such a, what would you call that? It's like a gesture, like, thank you, here's this, to thank you for helping me see the light. You know, it's kind of also symbolic because he's able to move on. He's able to pass this inanimate object to somebody. I just think it's a really interesting thing. Now, I'll play some of that where she goes in to return the music box.
Brought back your music box. It's too pretty to give away.
Small thanks. Trying to help me.
And there's a lot of dead air. There's a lot of just kind of pacing and a lot of just waiting around. But he does recite the scripture that affected him deeply. And I don't think it was the same scripture, was it? Do you recall?
No, it wasn't the same scripture. But like you were talking about the previously leading up to this, you know, the fact that she leaves the Bible in there, and then he reads. They show him reading it, and there is no dialogue really. Yeah. And then it shows her showing the ballerina scene of her, him remembering her. Then it's almost like, then she's gone, and he looks up like, you know, it's kind of like we say, you know, they say in the biblically, you know, first you believe, and then you're saved, kind of. And you see, mm-hmm. You know, I was blind, you know, Amazing Grace, I was blind, then I seen. It's almost like that it spoke to him, and then he came to realization, like you said, that she's gone, and, you know, he's kind of seen it. He is upset. He has to accept that. And he has it, you know, he wants to change, and it dawns on him, and that spiritually it's, you know, he was blind, now he sees.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, the greatest, you know, as within Christianity, we say the greatest gift you can give someone is their faith, that they believe. You know, you can, you know, plant the seed of what it means, and they believe. Their eyes are open, as they would say. Mm-hmm. And it kind of happens. His eyes are open, not just, are, you know, to what his situation is, and spiritually coming together because of Laura's act of love.
And also, in this scene, if you notice, all of a sudden you could see through the windows. I mean, obviously he cleaned, but
yep.
All of a sudden you can see the room. There's more life to it. It's no longer dreary. It's and that's something we didn't really comment too much on, but the house is beautifully decorated.
Yeah.
Very extravagant.
Yeah, I was wondering if they actually shot this. Some of the scenes, like I said, were shot inside that house. If they had the interiors of the house built for when they were shooting other films or television shows in the past, and they used that because of the natural lighting coming in is not a stage lighting from above. It doesn't seem like it. So it's almost, I wonder how much they actually shot the scenes that were in the house actually inside that house with the natural lighting during the day without. Because this is the lighting is very natural. There's no, like, stage lighting that's apparent in any of this other than when they're in the eating a dinner at the table, you know, in our little cabin or house, or the little house.
But I'm going to play the scene where he recites the scripture.
I read what you marked so many times. I knew every word by heart. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. And this one. Whosoever liveth and believeth in me shall never die. Does that mean she's up there in heaven?
Yes.
I want to believe that more than anything. I never was much for believing. I don't even know how to start.
Just have faith. That's what my pa says.
So that's the beauty. I mean, it's really the crux of all of this is to have faith. And I don't know. There you go. You get the Little House on the Prairie message, right? It's a sweet and very simple story when it comes down to it. Now, one thing I do want to mention is my dark theory as to what happened. But I think I'm wrong. I'm not 100%. But so I think that he was kind of obsessed with her, right? He, like you said, he was courting her from the theater. Is it possible he became so obsessed that he, you know, maybe, I'm not saying he killed her, but it just seems to me, is it possible he just brought her body to Walnut Grove? I mean, it seems like he was just the number one fan at some point. Didn't seem as though, like, there was never a discussion of she coming to the house or anything. She didn't give up her career to come and marry him, right? I don't know.
I don't see that, really, that angle at all. What I see when I was looking at this, after watching this episode, thinking about it afterwards, my couple questions I had. If you remember, she kept her stage name, which professional people do. She kept Lily Baldwin was her last name. So she was Lily Baldwin, you know, on her stage, even though if she married him, her name would have been Lily Baldwin Pike, which a lot of women do. Like my sister does that. She was a photographer in the newspaper. She kept her professional name. And the thing is, also, I'm thinking of this, maybe the story is he was a rich person. He went and seen her. She found out she liked him, and she said, wow, I'm an actress. You know, what kind of future would I have? Well, if I marry this rich person who's well-to-do, built a house, yes, I'll marry him. And I also wondered, did she really, you know, that? And then she, like I said, she got married to him. They moved to the country, and she got bored. But I wondered if she got, you know, if she really, did she ever go back to Mankato and go back to acting, or did she die there? You know, did she... Mm. You know, I wondered if she, you know, he says she left me. Does it really, maybe
she did leave him.
Marriage, yeah. But she didn't actually leave him and go back to the stage. But that's how he was dealing with what her death is saying. Well, she left. She went back to the stage. She's going to come back. And it was part of a psychosis in his mind that maybe she was just unhappily married because her career was over. Mm. She married and she was they never had kids. There's never speaking of, so or ever being a mother, but I wondered if she ever really did go back to the stage, or like when Laura was talking to the gentleman, he had memories of her, but maybe she never came back. He remembered seeing her when she was famous. Maybe she got married and left and then she died.
Now on her tombstone, it says Lily Baldwin Pike and beloved wife.
Yeah.
Says that she was born in 18, maybe 32. I'm thinking that's his 1832. Let's guess that this, she was probably about 20 years old. That would probably make her, let's say in 1852, she passed away. Cause this is 1875, 72, right?
So, yeah, 75, 72, something like that.
And he's like saying 20 years ago. So, I don't know. It's a very strange thing. At first, I thought maybe that they never even married. See, he doesn't even talk about getting married. He just talks about, you know, asking her to marry her. Who knows? I mean, it's all speculation, of course.
Yeah, it's the economy of writing, too. Which you have so many minutes to get an episode, you know, to have the story, you know, almost so much TV time, unless it's split.
Yes.
So a lot of times it's economy of writing of like Kenneth Johnson, you know, a well-known 70s writer for Incredible Hulk and Creator, all that.
Yeah.
He always talked about economy of writing. Like the fact that Jack, when she mentioned to Mary that I'm going to take Jack with me, I said, that's just a plot convenience. Jack's going to go into the house and she's going to follow. I seen that coming. And I said, that's just a plot device to get Laura in there. Well, let's write that line in there. So we don't have to spend so much time on how she got in there. We're just going to say Jack jumped in after, of course, a cat who dogs don't like. And she's going to go in. So it was almost like a plot contrivance to move the story to get it from going. So we didn't dwell so much on that part of the narrative or part of the episode.
Jack looked so lazy. He probably had to cover the cat in bacon grease in order to get him to chase it.
Yeah, literally. Yeah, he's a pretty more of a timid dog. Except for when raccoons are around.
He looks exactly like, I have a Maltese, which is a little guy. And Jack basically looks exactly like a big version of my dog, except my dog is pure white. But when he goes out in the mud and gets dirty, he looks a lot like Jack. What Little House show like this would be complete without a kind of a joke on some level, because you can't just kind of end this on such a sad note like so many other episodes. So they see Laura coming out of the house, and this is what happens.
What did he say?
What?
What did he say?
He said he wanted to see you, Nellie.
What?
He said he wanted to see you. And Willie, too.
But not the other girl, because we don't know your name.
I gotta go home and do some chores now.
Me too.
And they go running off, and that's the Laura that we know and love, the practical joker, never missing an opportunity to stick it to Nellie and Willie. Gerald, I want to thank you so much for taking the time today to have a discussion about this episode. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, you know, it was interesting before we go.
Yeah.
At the end, there's two things that tie together. At the end, she says, I'll see you on Sunday, which basically is telling you he's going to go to church.
Oh, I missed that. Now, Very good.
And that also opens up the narrative that he's willing to change, not just with her and his thoughts of what Lily lost, but he's going to interact with who's at church? The rest of the town. Everybody in town goes to church through Reverend Alden's message. So people are going to get to learn a little more about him. They won't think he's just this crazy maniac man as he was called by the Miss Olson. And he's going to become involved and maybe in the town, in the people's lives more. They're going to get to learn about him. And in the beginning of the episode, when he goes to pay for that, you know, goes to their store and he doesn't say anything, but he looks up on the wall and they show, zoom in on a sign. It's a little flyer that says Women's Social, and it's, I believe, a dance.
Yeah, you know what? Like, you know what? I'm so glad you brought that up because I completely forgot about it. It says Women's League Social Saturday.
Yes.
And what is that? Like, what was the zoom in for?
Well, to show that it's a woman's run thing, which would make us think of his wife. And the fact is, as the episode goes, a few minutes later, he's talking to Lily saying, you'd be the eye of the dance, the recital or the social thing. People would admire you and your dancing. Yeah. So that's what kind of triggered, and I think that triggered his memories maybe of about her again and got the episode going, is there's that beginning with the sign.
That's a great observation.
And then it ends with him wanting to be a changed man, not just for Laura and honoring his ex-wife. The fact that he's going to be indirectly, when you go to church, everybody in town is at church. So the people are going to see he's not this crazy old man. This is why he was the way he was. We heard about, people were rumoring about why he was the way he was, but I'm sure now he's going to interact, talk with people, and become involved more in the community, which we never see the character
again.
But it shows you he's willing to invest in the people now, not just invest in himself, in a home, in himself, and at his loss, and being stuck in that world. He's willing to open his eyes, and he's willing to see. He was saved, now he's willing to see.
Right, that creates the potential for him to actually have a life.
Yep.
Oh, that's a great observation, seriously. Because I completely forgot about the sign. Yeah. But I think Haunted, I think this is a great first episode. I think if people want to know, you know, what kind of heart, what kind of message, have a little bit of comedy, not too much Mary or Carrie, it's perfect. Not too much Ma either.
No, this is an episode that shows what this show is capable of. Like we say on the other show, we have the OSI Files, $6 Million Man. It's not anywhere near narratively as strong as this show is. I mean, talking episode to episode, you have a lot of what John and I would call pedestrian episodes that any show could have been. Steve Austin didn't need anything special for him really to make it a $6 Million Man episode. But there are episodes that really show at the core what he's about. Well, this episode shows at the core who Laura is, who Charles is, and what the creators of the show are able to do narratively on what could be considered a very, a fine rope line of a subject to talk about death.
Do you
put
ever
some faith inside that?
Do you ever talk on the $6 Million Man about $6 million adjusted for inflation?
Oh yeah, we've talked about
like the $35 million man.
Yeah, and then there's a joke when Oscar's talking to Jamie, who was the bionic woman. She says, "Well, you spent $6 million." He says, "Well, a little less. Your limbs are a little smaller. So it cost us less."
Is that a line from the show?
Yeah, that's a line.
That's clever.
He's talking to the first episode, "Welcome Back, Jamie," of the bionic woman. They're having a little conversation, and she's like, you know, I owe you guys. I want to work. He's like, no, Jamie. He's like, hey, you know, if you don't give me an assignment, I'm just going to come down and kick their door down. And he's like, yeah, I know you're just the woman to do it.
Why have they not rebooted the $6 million Man?
I think that what are they going to do? The movie, a $6 billion with Mark Wahlberg to kind of crash and burn, and nobody in the fandom wants to see a Mark Wahlberg. He's too old. And really, they want it serious where everyone's afraid it's going to be a lighthearted Jim Carrey type take on the characters. It's going to be a parody.
I
mean,
I am such a fan of not only, I'm a big fan of the original Battlestar Galactica, but I'm a tremendous fan of the reboot of Battlestar Galactica. I think it was insanely successful and a really wonderful series. I'm not sure if you ever watched it.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's the finest reboot of a television show I've ever seen.
Too.
It touched so many layers of life. Like I said, there's politics, there's religion, there's relationships.
God.
There's God. Why? Who
creation.
Makes
us?
Yeah.
It's nuts.
It's us gods. Why should we play God? Yeah. Is the whole idea, like his speech in the pilot movie is, you know, when Yadama announces over the PA to everybody, you know, we play God, and this is what happens when we humans play God. You know, and I mean, yeah, I agree with you. It's probably the finest reboot of any show that I've ever seen.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I'm trying to get my son to get into it. Might be a little too intense. Maybe not, though. But I would, you know, if you're going to do a reboot like that, I mean, you take the original one, which really had zero correlation with the reboot. I love the fact that it's so well thought out. So taking something like the $6 million Man and making it something a little bit bigger would be really interesting. I don't know. I don't know if you can really do that again. But yeah, I am personally sick of reboots. I think everyone is. I've been sick of reboots since they rebooted Psycho back in 1996. I've been kind of against it since then.
Yeah, it's a tough thing to line across because you got the fans, the previous fans, and a new generation, and and it depends on how old of the show is. You got life and culturally was different. I mean, at the time that this show, Little House, $6 Million Man, you just got out of Watergate, you got out of Vietnam, you still had that creeping in the psyche of America and the world, and some of that stuff creeped into 70s television.
Yeah.
And that if you do it nowadays, there's, you know, what's going on politically in the world right now, you know, especially in our country and things that are going on. It's a very hard dynamic. And that's why I think this episode of Little House is a great example of all around excellence in terms of storytelling.
Sure.
And there's a lot of episodes in Little House of Prairie that are like this, but I think this is one of the stronger episodes showing that what the production crew that had previously come over and has a long history of working in television and film and the entertainment industry, you could tell there was a very veteran hands production-wise and acting-wise over this episode.
Yeah, this is a very different episode. Very different. And and I really enjoyed it. But again, thank you so much for taking the time to do this. Can you just mention where people could find the OS Files podcast?
Oh, the OSI files? Sure, I'll just...
I keep calling it the wrong thing. I am so sorry.
OSI, that's the Office
OSI.
Of Investigation or Intelligence. It changed from episode to episode what those initials meant. But yeah, I'm actually, I'm part of what John S. Drew is the main host. I'm the co-host. We do a weekly episode review, season by season. This is going on our fourth year, which is the fourth season of The $6 Million Man, where we review episodes. You can find us called the OSI Files. You can find us on Facebook and on iTunes and Stitcher. Just type up OSI Files. And originally started out a show called Cyborgs, and then John, you know, that ended. John created this one and asked me on after being a guest. As being an artist illustrator, I get asked to be on podcasts, I guess. People... I guess like my opinions are what I have to bring to the table.
You definitely bring a lot to the table, so that's a good thing.
So then people weren't able to fill in, and then he noticed I was available. He kept reaching out saying, can you come in this week? Can you come in this week? And then he said, you know what? Why don't you just be a co-host with me? Then I don't have to find two other people. We just find one person to come on as a co-host. So we have hosts from around the world. We've had illustrator from Pete from Britain come on. We have people from all around the world, all around the country on weekly as guests, and we review episode by episode in order, we try to, and then we discuss it, and it's called the OSI Files, and then on that Sundays at 8 o'clock Eastern Time, we start up again the new season September 20th on Facebook Live, just like us there, and you'll get the notices if you like the page. And then on Wednesdays, we have the Bionic Woman, which I'm not on that with John. It's Elizabeth Goddard. And we wanted to have a female perspective, which I thought was a good thing to do with the Bionic Woman. So he has her on Wednesdays, and they review episode by episode of the Bionic Woman.
And do you do it chronologically?
Time. Yep, we do it chronologically. That's why I said we started with episode 1 3 years ago. Actually, the pilot movies, the three of them, then episode 1 3 years ago. Then the summer break comes, and we maybe catch up or do reruns. Then next season will start in September, which is season 2, then season 3. Now season 4 is September. Then we'll start off with The Return of Bigfoot, which is the two-parter. Which
it's a big one. You remember when you were a kid, you know, Bigfoot was a big deal. There were two things that were a big deal. Bigfoot and quicksand. Those are the two things I thought were going to be a big part of my future.
Yep, that's why I think part of this episode we talked about has got a little bit of spiritualism, and you're talking about maybe some of the occult things that Amir talking. Well, that was a big thing. Paranormal, cryptids, and you know, the Bigfoot, the Loch Ness Monster, or UFOs was in the 70s really started to explode in culture. So a lot of television dealt with that. But yes, so you can reach out to on OSI Files on Facebook to find out when we start in September.
Awesome.
And then I'm also an illustrator. That's my nighttime job. I'm a government employee during the day. And I have a website. I've done print work, poster design work for theatrical posters for Star Wars and that for local theaters. And
Beautiful work. I've seen a lot of your custom work, but also more of your production work. And it's really, really just amazingly top-notch, Yeah, I'm just like really blown away by what you can create with your hands, and it's something that I've always been a designer. I've worked for the Village Voice and a number of different newspapers where I would design the covers and the different editorial layouts, trying to be creative and retro. But I'm not a very good physical artist, and I tend to just have, and people have said that I have very good taste. It's just, I'm not a great artist when, if I were to draw a picture of you, it looks more like Charlie Brown than it does real. But that could be good too, right?
Cartoon. You're a designer. I was a designer for years, corporate designer too, and it's all about arranging the elements on the page, visually appealing to a general audience. But like I was saying, they can reach out. I have a website at www.geraldlang.com. I have my work. I've done theatrical poster work and some illustration. I've done a comic book cover for Image Comics. I've done some comic book work and various covers and that. And I have a store there with my prints and my art. I published a couple art books of my own.
Oh, man. You got to post this stuff. I need the links. And
I'll send you a link for the store notes. Yeah, I self-published a couple art books, nothing super fancy. And then, I'm on Instagram at Gerald E. Lang. When I can keep up, I'm so far behind on Instagram. I got far behind with social media. It's hard to keep up with working full-time job and illustration. Then I have I'm on Facebook at Gerald E. Lang. I also do Funko Pops. That's what I've been working on. You mentioned custom art on Funko Pop. That's one of my clients now doing some Funko Pop art for a client and on the outside of the box. So it makes them one of a kind. Where the Funko, everybody's got the Funko Pop. They're the ugliest things in the world, I think. I don't like them, but the figures in a box are nice. But when I do the artwork on the side of them for clients, it makes them exclusive. You can mark
it's really cool.
And on the figure itself, and people that collect that stuff just love it because it makes it one of a kind original. So people can reach out to me. I'll be doing shows. I'll have that listed on my website when I do conventions, or they can email me and let me know what they're looking for, and I can try to purchase the Funko Pop and then just quote my price on doing the artwork, and I can do custom Funko Pops. And I'm hopefully going to do some I want to do a couple prints for Little House, some of the characters I like. I think I want to do a Laura Ingalls and use some reference photos from and I'll share that with you, and you can share it with the viewers once I get something together. But I'm thinking about doing a Little House, a couple pieces art inspired.
I definitely would be interested in purchasing one because, I love your art. So, and when you do post these Funko Pops, it also looks like you're having a lot of fun with it, which I think sometimes artists don't have the fun, And it looks like you're just kind of being very natural about it. Now, Funko Pops, I agree with you. My son buys them and collects them, and he's the large, the child, the Baby Yoda thing. But why, they have everything. They have The Office, Doctor Who, everything. Why don't they have Little House ones? It's unbelievable. Yeah. They've missed their mark. Time and time again, Little House on the Prairie has the worst marketing of all time.
No, I agree that we're wondering that too about the $6 million man. That is so toyability of the. I mean, Little House wasn't a toyability show. We call it back even now or back then, where you can make merchandise off it. Where even nowadays shows are more about the toys, especially come to kids. But even the $6 million man, there's no Funko Pops, and I know we love the show, but how many?
There's no Steve people Austin. Are going to want a
Charles Ingalls Funko Pop.
I would buy it, but
we're fans of the shows, but general people are like. Who's that? Unless you're a parent our age or older.
No, you're right. But you'd be. I mean, I'm sure you've seen some of these Funko Pops and the properties that they've released. I mean, I'm
staring at some in front of me. I have a Venomized Hulk. I'm doing. I have a Mandalorian. I have a Princess Leia.
Those are cool ones, though. They have ones where it's like The Office. You know, it's like you have Jim Halpert. You know, it's like what. I mean, I guess it's modern, you know, so it makes more sense. But they even tried to push a Little House on the Prairie Lego set.
That would be cool. Or I seen one on her Facebook page, One Up Grovecast. Didn't somebody share a link, which I want to do, and I didn't get a chance, a papercraft version of Little House of the house and stuff. And I think the horse and buggy or something like that. I wanted to print that stuff up and make it. I just haven't had a chance.
Yeah, you know, I downloaded them all. I don't remember their link off the top of my head. I'll put it in the show notes. But it's beautiful work that they do. They do it. It's a labor of love. And it's really, really done so well. And I've been meaning to have – I wanted to have them come on and talk about it. Just not enough time in the day. You get everybody on, but I am glad that you took the time to get on here and speak to me about this.
Thank you. I appreciate when people ask me on, and you know, I appreciate when anybody asks you. Then you know, they obviously want you to invest the time, and they actually people value when they invite somebody on. There's some value of what they have to say, and it's not just about you and I. It's about what your listeners, and can they gain something from what you and I have to say about the episode. That's why I'm so appreciative whenever I've been asked on different podcasts or even on the one I take with John. I take it seriously as and I do the research and I kind of, you know, make sure I'm prepared. So it's not just about me. It's about what the people are going to get from this episode that are listening to it.
Yeah. And I think that we touched upon a lot of really interesting things from different perspectives. And, but Gerald, I really appreciate the time that you put into this. Gerald from the OSI Files podcast. I got it right for the first time in this episode. But definitely check out his stuff. I'm going to put a link to it in the show notes. You can find him on the Facebook group. You know, it's and that's another thing. I really love the community that we've kind of created. And, nobody seems to really be nasty, which is a rarity.
That's a rarity, especially in pop culture, like we were talking. And yeah, if you do more episodes, like me back, just reach out to me.
Oh, absolutely.
Another with you. I enjoyed it, and I actually. Like I said, The $6 Million Man is a show, you know, I have great memories of, but I tell John, I tell everybody, this is the show I have the most memories of growing up.
It's crazy.
My parents controlled, and my grandfather, my uncle owned a farm, so my grandfather was there. My parents moved in and lived at my grandfather growing up, and the house that are now is my grandfather's, you know, and they got the house we passed. But my uncle had a farm, you know, up in Angelica, which it's 170 acres of woods. You had the upper and lower log roads, and you had the tractor riding in that old Ford tractor with the trailer sitting in the back, bouncing up and down this wooden trailer they made. And this show was my grandfather's favorite, my parents, so we were always watching. So I have the time growing up, this is the show I remember the most. Everything from Mary going blind to meeting Albert to the blind school, which I'll get to these episodes as I'm watching now, to Almanzo, which I always said, oh my god, that's like a grown man and she's in love with this grown man and Charles gonna let her marry this grown man, you know, and his sister Almanzo's, if I remember, she's very delicate.
What's his woman. Name I'm sorry,
Almanzo, whatever you want to call him.
We don't say Almanzo on this show, sir.
Oh, that's true. It was Manly, so Manzo. And I think that's the actual pronunciation. Unless you ask
it is.
He goes Almanzo, right? Dean says, I think.
Yeah, it's Almanzo. According to Dean Butler, it's he's made the record straight, and I've been trying my best to make it a fact. We have to go back and re-edit the thing. We have to do a voiceover for the entire series. That would be a funny thing to do, actually.
Did I hear him listed as a patron, too?
Yeah, he supports the show. He's a friend. You know, it's like these people, they reach out from time to time. They're very nice. And I can't thank the people who were a part of the Little House on the Prairie universe for being so welcoming of this podcast and coming and speaking to me. And from time to time, they'll send me stuff or I'll get a text. David Friedman, you know, who played, I'm forgetting his character, one of the newer guys. I get texts from him from time to time, you know, just kind of like talking about music. You know, they're just such incredible people. And I've not had a bad experience with any of them. And I'm just really, really blessed to have their attention. And there's a mosquito in here. And I just hit the microphone. Sorry.
Melissa Gilbert to come on, because I know her and Allison are really good. I know what Melissa, her husband, which was, I think, the actor from 30-something he was on, I believe. And they live in New York. And I think they're like on a country, but it'd be great, hopefully, to have her embrace and come on. But yeah, it's great because I think of some of the actors were at that age where they still remember being on the show. Whereas you get a lot of the shows in the 70s, you have a lot of the actors that are really old now. And if you interview some of them, or some of them don't want to be interviewed because they say, honestly, it was a job, but I don't have a lot of memories of it because that was so long ago. Unless it was a certain thing, they have their memories fade as they get older. Yeah. And it's hard. But in the case of this and other shows like the Brady Bunch stuff they're on, a lot of the actors were just at that age or old enough to be aware of what they were doing as actors and can still remember.
There are a lot of things lined up for the near future. This pandemic has really screwed up a lot of plans that I had with different interviews and people who were scheduled to come on. The interviews are tough, but I'm working on it. They're all, you know, everybody's on my wish list, but there are certain people who are more difficult to access than others.
Yeah.
I'm just going to say flat out, I don't believe Melissa Sue Anderson will ever come on. But I'm going to guess that maybe she's the only one. That's my teaser.
What is it, Matthew that played Albert? How do you pronounce his last name?
Labrador. Matthew Labrador is also another one. I don't believe he'll ever come on. I think he's afraid to come on, Matthew, if you're listening right now. But
he's afraid he probably won't remember and doesn't want to, doesn't want to really off-put the fans.
He's an old man now. Come on, Gerald.
Well, he's only a couple of years older than you and I.
He's like practically our age. Like, you know, it's like, no, I mean, I'm kidding. I understand it. People want to move on. They want to do other things. And I fully respect that and understand it. But there's definitely a lot of work going on with trying to get different people to come on. I'll tell you more off the air.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider supporting Walnut Grovecast by heading over to patreon.com/walnutgrovecast. Any support is appreciated.